Okay, so welcome to our, I've lost count of how many shiurim we're on. I have no idea. I think 7th or 8th for the day. Thank you for all who came. Thank you for everyone who's been watching online. Again, as the beginning of every shiur, thank you to our sponsors for the entire program, Serena and David Kuchitsky, in memory of Riva Kuchitsky, Zichrona Livracha, and the Weinbaum Foundation. For this year in specific, I also thank my parents, Beth and Mark Ziering, for sponsoring it in honor of my grandmother's 10th yahrzeit, Sarah Bas Svi Hirsch, which was yesterday. Thank you to Or Chaim for hosting, to Peter for doing the webcast. I don't know how you're going to stay awake all day. We at least take breaks. But and as we've mentioned, this program is also supporting our university programming daily for men here at Or Chaim and for women at Ulpana Orot. And if you know anyone who is interested in joining us, please let them know. There are donor cards here and at the door. Okay, and the last introductory note is, in addition, this program one of our goals was to showcase the types of shiurim that we have in the community, the opportunities we have in the community throughout the year. So what we're doing now is a little bit of literary analysis of Chumash, of Tanakh. I give two somewhat regular shiurim on it, one regularly every week at Carol's here at 2:30 on Wednesdays. The information is on Toronto Torah. And then up north, when I give Parsha shiurim at the No Frills Minyan, those from up north know what I'm talking about. I use this style often as well. Okay, so let's jump right into it. So what I wanted to do was analyze a little bit yesterday's Parsha. I debated between yesterday's Parsha and this coming week's, but I figure no one has yet read next week's Parsha, and if you were in shul, you at least heard yesterday's Parsha, so we'll start with that one. So, we find three successive laws at the beginning of yesterday's Parsha. The law of the Yifat Tovar, of the beautiful woman captured in battle. You can come in, we just started. There are sources in the back. The second is the case of someone who has two wives, who loves one of them and hates the other. And the third is the story of the rebellious child. So the three laws are discussed in source one. So, Ki teitzei la milchama oloivecha, unitano Hashem elokecha biyadecha vishavita shivyo. When one goes to war, and God gives you your enemy in your hand, and you take captives. And one of those captives is Ra'ita Bashivyaish at Yifat Tovar. You see a beautiful woman, V'chashakteba, and you're overcome with desire. V'lokachta l'chalisha, so you take her as a wife. V'aveita al toch beitecha, so take her into your house. V'gilchat rosha, v'asisa et siparnea, shave her head and let her nails grow. V'esirat simlat shivya me'alea, and remove her fancy clothes, the ones that she was in when she was captured from her. And she'll sit in your house and mourn her parents, the loss of her family, for a month. And the way Rashi understands this, as the Gemara notes, the goal of these laws was to dissuade the person from marrying her. The Torah recognize that when going out to war, it couldn't necessarily outright forbid the taking of the woman, but it could dissuade you. So by providing a procedure one would go through in order to marry her, hopefully by the end of the 30 days, your passion would have waned and you would not marry her. But if after 30 days you still want to marry her, you can. But if you don't want to marry her after 30 days, so let her go free. If you aren't allowed to take her as a slave, you can't sell her for money. You can't oppress her because you have already caused her pain. So that's law one. The law of the beautiful captive woman. The second law is the law of one with two wives. Ki tiena li'ish shtei nashim. A person has two wives, biblically. The Torah allows polygamy. It was forbidden by decree by Rabbeinu Gershom Moragola in the 10th century. But biblically, one can have more than one wife. So if one has two wives, achat ahuva v'achat snu'a, one is beloved and one is not. One is hated. V'yaldu lo vanim. And then he has children from both. Ahuva v'hasnu'a. V'hayan, as it'll be, what'll happen? Ha ben ha'bechor lasni'a. His firstborn, therefore, the one who's going to get a double portion, is the child of the hated wife. So now, he wants to give the double portion to the daughter, to the child of his beloved wife, but he can't. So the Torah tells him, on the day that he's going to pass away and bequeath his property to his children, he isn't allowed to give the rights to the elder, to the younger son. Oh, I forgot to put this on. The elder son is the son of the hated wife, and he is therefore the firstborn and gets the double rights. The rights will go to the firstborn because he is the firstborn regardless of the fact that he is the child of the hated wife. And then we have a third striking law. If a person has a rebellious child, he doesn't listen to his parents, and they try, they chastise him, and it doesn't work. So they take him out to the elders, and they say, this child doesn't listen, he's a glutton, he's a drunkard, right? And as the Gemara goes on to explain, he's a thief, and potentially will become a murderer. So you take out this child, which the Gemara understands to be a 12-year-old, and they stone him. As the Gemara said, Yamut Zakai Val Yamut Chayav. He dies while he is innocent and not when he has become guilty. Now, all three of these laws are difficult to understand. The law of the Fatar, the law of Ahuv Asnua, and the law of Ben Saramor are very difficult to understand. What I'm going to try to do is not try to tackle it head on and try to understand why does the Torah allow for this institution. Is it battlefield rape? Is it not? It's not. As evidenced by the fact you have to wait a month. According to the Taz, everyone agrees that you can't do it against her will. The only question is if she wants to get married, by what process could you convert her? I don't want to get into the details there. How is it just that you kill this 12-year-old for eating too much food and stealing a little bit from his parents? So again, the Talmud there says it never happened. It's just teaching it to you so you understand the values that are inherent in. What values are those? That's a share for another time. I have them online. You can try to find them. They're somewhere. What I want to do is I want to look at this from a different point. Sometimes the Torah gives you a set of laws, and what you see is what you get. But sometimes it's not the case. Sometimes history speaks law, and law speaks history. And if you look at the laws, and you're sensitive, and you follow the literary cues and clues, so you'll realize that what seems to be a legal passage is in fact a hidden commentary, or is built on a perception or an understanding of a narrative that has already appeared in the Chumash before, in the Torah before. And to understand the laws, you need to understand the narrative. And to understand the narrative, you need to understand the laws. And what I want to do here is tackle this unit from that perspective. My wife is starting a series on this after Sukkot, where she's just doing, I think it's five shirim on just this topic, on how history and law are related. Here, I think it's at Opana. Okay. So, what story is this? So, before we get to the story, I want to make one more point about this unit. And that's a point that Chazal pick up on in 2. The rabbis in 2, this I'll read in the English, suggest that in order to understand these laws, what you first have to realize is this isn't just three laws that happen to be next to each other, but that there's a logical progression. And they write as follows in 2. Our rabbis taught, one mitzvah leads to another mitzvah. One transgression leads to another transgression. And you see among the captives a beautiful woman, and he shall shave, and she shall shave her hair. Right, those laws. There we go. So that she will not find favor in his eyes. What is written afterwards? If a man has two wives in the house, strife in the house. Right, polygamy. The rabbis understood that the Torah never liked polygamy; just allowed it. Furthermore, if one is beloved and one is hated, or both are hated, what is written afterwards? If a man has a wayward and defiant son, anyone who married an Eshet Yifas Tohar, right, the captive woman, will have a Ben Sarah Mora come from him, will have a rebellious child, as we found with David. Right, the Midrash says that this is what King David did, as he desired Ma'acha, daughter of Tamai, king of Geshur, and he went out to war, and Avshalom came from him, and who was the child of Ma'acha, this captive woman? Avshalom, his child who rebelled against him, and staged a coup, who wanted to kill him, slept with his wives to the eyes of all of Israel in front of the sun, meaning in public. Because of him, many myriads of Jews were killed and caused strife in Israel. And the rabbis of the Midrash suggest that the first thing you need to understand is that it's not just that these laws happen to exist in the same parsha. They follow. Because if you are overcome with lust, and even after all the Torah's attempts to dissuade you from marrying this woman, you marry her anyways, you're going to hate her. It's going to happen. Right? This is not a woman that you fell in love with for good reasons. Right? You were on the battlefield and you overcome. Okay, so the Torah allowed you, gave you a procedure by which to marry her, but you're going to hate her. And when you hate her, so you're going to get another wife. You are. You don't want, right? You don't want to be married to her. So if you have another wife, you're going to have two. If you don't like her, you're going to be married to someone else. And you know what's going to happen then? You're going to have a house where you have a hated wife. There's going to be tension in the house. And you're going to have a child. And you're not going to want that child to be your heir. You have to make him your heir. But he's going to know you don't want him to be your heir. Even if you give it to him. So you know what he's going to do? He's going to rebel. Right? And if ever there was going to be a son who was going to rebel the way the Psukim describe it, it's going to be the son from this wet marriage. And who is that person? What was the closest we ever came? Avshalom. Right? The child of David. David, as the Midrash says, captured a woman in war, married her. It was a political marriage. He has multiple sons. Avshalom is not the chosen son. He's not the heir to the throne, but he wants to be. So he stages a coup. And as part of the coup, right, how do you show power? Right, if you take over a normal king, you go the ancient world, you would go into the harem of the king, and you would sleep with his wife to show that I've taken over. Well, that's what he did, even though this was his father, and these were his whatever. I don't know exactly how you refer to the other wives of your father, stepmothers. And the rabbis of the Midrash say that this is, right, a progression. This is a cause and effect. We don't want you to marry this woman. And if you do, it's not going to turn out well. So now, did this ever happen? So the Midrash says it never really happened. Never fully. We never had someone who perfectly followed this. But do we know of any woman, any who was married because she was beautiful, any man who had multiple wives, of which one was beloved and one was not so beloved, of children who rebelled against their father and caused chaos in his life and the lives of others? Yaakov. Yaakov, right? Yaakov. And if you look at the front, well, okay, I'll show one pasuk. Before we have the Eshet Yifat Tohar, we have another Yifat Tohar. We actually have multiple Yifat Tohar, but one of them is Rachel. Yaakov is fleeing from Esav. He comes to the city where he knows that he's going to see his family. And who's standing there but a beautiful woman who happens to be his cousin and his future wife, Rachel. And the pasuk says, "V'Rachel hayta yifat tohar." She was beautiful. But those key words, yifat tohar, right? Ki teitei lamilchama, when you go out to war and you see Eshet Yifat Tohar, and he is enamored with her. Right? He runs over to her, he kisses her. If you want to see it visually, look at the first page. Right? The front page, the picture. I wanted you to see this in multiple forms. So there's a painting, a famous painting from 1853 from William Dyce of Jacob and Rachel. And look, this is his depiction of what's going on in that story. Right? Look at him falling over her, right? You have this beautiful woman. He's falling, right? He just met her, right? And he's literally collapsing, right? He has one arm around her, right? He's totally dumbstruck when he's looking at her, right? This is how he describes that scene. But it's a fair portrayal of that scene. And you think about it, right? It's not war, right? This is not a captive, but that notion, You're going out and you see Eshet Yifa Tor Vichashakta Bavilakhta Lakhalisha. You love her, you'll do anything. Right? You'll do anything. Have her 30 days in your house, shave her head, let her nails grow, and wait until you can marry her? Done. Work for 7 years for her father, get tricked, and do it again? Right? Done. Whatever it takes. Right? That first moment, Eshet Yifa Tor, and you fall in love. Now, if that was the only hint, that would be nothing, because the words Yifat Tohar come up. Okay? But it turns out that Yaakov's life follows a predictable progression, but we have to try to interpret it. So if you look at source 3, so this is, I'm sorry this source is not in English, but here, I wanted to show the literary parallels. You have to look at the Hebrew, because you have to see the, right, in English you won't see the literary parallels, but I'll explain it. So on the right-hand side, I have the story of Yaakov. I have random verses picked out of the life of Yaakov. And on the left, I have the unit that we've just seen, the unit of the Yifat Tohar. So, on the right, when Yaakov finally leaves, he finally escapes. Lavan, his father-in-law, chases him because he escaped in the middle of the night. And he catches him. And he says to Yaakov, "Why did you run away with my daughters? Vantin haget binotai kishvuyot charev. What, you took my daughters as if they're captives of war? Right? Kishvuyot charev. Right? On the left side, ki teitzei lamilchama vishavita shivyo. Right? If you go out into war and you take a captive, who's the captive? The woman. The Eshet Yifat Tohar. Well, that's who Rachel is. Right? And that's how they describe Rachel and Leah are shvuyot charev. Furthermore, Vayhi Kasher Ra'a Yaakov et Rachel, or the emphasis, he saw Rachel and realized, V'Rachel Hayta Yifatar Vit Mareh. You see, he saw her, and he saw she was beautiful, which is what we have. V'Ra'ita Bashivya Eshet Yifatar. You see her, and she's beautiful. And then continuing, how long did Yaakov stay before he actually, you know, got involved in the marriage proposal? Vayeshev imo chodesh yamim, a month. From when he saw the beautiful woman, he stayed with Lavan a month. And if you look on the left, uvachtar avia verima yerach yamim, and the woman will stay in his house yerach yamim, a month. And if you look at the midrash, I gave you a midrash at the bottom of that chart, as if the midrash wants to tell you there's a parallel. It says, you know what was going on during those 30 days? Leah was crying because she wanted to marry Yaakov and not Esav. And she thought, if Yaakov, the younger brother, marries Rachel, the younger sister, then I might marry Esav. So he is there 30 days, and there's someone crying for 30 days, according to the Midrash, in this house of Lavan. And it continues into the next unit. He loved Rachel, and therefore Hashem saw that his other wife, Leah, was hated. Right? Because if you remember the story, he's supposed to marry Rachel. Lavan tricks him, gives him Leah. He ends up working another 7 years, ends up marrying both. But he always really wanted to be married to Rachel. Now he's married to both. So Leah was always the second wife. She was always the least loved. He loved one, he hated the other. Two wives. Right, that's what we just saw, right? Achat ahuvav, achat snu'a. And then he has a son, right? He has many sons. His bechor, who has the firstborn?
Leah.
Rachel is barren for many years. The bechor is Reuven, and he's not just the bechor, but if you look on the right, when Yaakov describes him, it's Reuven bechoriata. You are my bechor, my firstborn. Kochi vireshit oni, the first of my strength. On the left, Vaya ben abachor lasnyav, the firstborn is to the hated wife. Kihu reshit ono, because he is the first of his strength. And you follow it, and parallel after parallel, from these three little units of the Yifat Tohar, of the right of the captive woman, of the two wives, and of the rebellious child, you find in the Yaakov story. Rachel is the Yifat Tohar, Rachel and Leah are Kishvu Yod Charev, are the captive women. Leah is the hated wife. Reuven, as we will see, will be the rejected firstborn from the hated wife. And we all know that all of Yaakov's life unravels because he shows favoritism to Ben Ha'ahuva, right? The beloved child, as opposed to Ben Hasnua, or Bnei Hasnua, Rachel, all of Leah's children, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvulun, and all the other children, the children of the other wives as well. And it's further, what Reuven ends up being rejected. Why does he end up being rejected? Four. Vayhi bishkon Yisrael baretz ahi vayelech Reuven. Reuven goes, according to Pesukim, vayishkav et Bilha pilegesh aviv. He sleeps with his father's other wife, Bilha. Which the rabbis understand, he didn't really sleep with her. He just moved the bed from her tent into his mother's tent because he took it as an affront that after the death of Rachel, Bilha was made the main wife and not Reuven's. But the simple read of the Pesukim, he sleeps with his father's concubine, which if you remember according to the Midrash, who is the paradigmatic if Ben Soromor, rebellious son? Avshalom, for doing what? Sleeping with Pilag She'aviv, the concubines of his father. Right, so Reuven is a Ben Sorer Moreh, and guess what? He's also the child who is firstborn, and does he get the right to the firstborn?
No.
In five, Reuven Bechoriata, you are my firstborn, Kochiv Reishit Oni Yeter Sevi Yeter Az, but Pachas Kamayim Alto Tarki Alita Mishkevei Avicha Az Chilalta Yitzilei Allah, but you are, right, you are unstable as water, and you shall excel no longer. For when you mounted your father's bed, you brought disgrace, my couch, he mounted, etc. And not only Reuven, but Shimon and Levi, the next two kids, also get rejected as the next firstborns, because what do? What's the other thing that Ben Saramora does, according to the Midrash? He's murderous. Mm-hmm. Guess who did that one? Right, Shimon and Levi, when Dinah is captured, right, as revenge, they kill the city of Shechem single-handedly, and Yaakov says, what are you doing? You're going to cause war. You're going to make us all die, which is what the Midrash said Avshalom actually did, right? Myriads of Jews died. That's what Yaakov was afraid of. Now, what does this all tell us? Well, before we figure out what it tells us, let's figure out whether this, in fact, works parallel. So, at first, it seems sort of nice, right? You have Yaakov meets the Ifat Toar. He ends up hating a wife. He has rebellious children. The Psukim are acting as a commentary on Yaakov's life and saying he really shouldn't have done that, right? He really shouldn't have loved right, Rachel more than Leah, because look what it did to his family, and that's why his kids rebelled, and there's a problem. There's a lot of problems. Right, so first of all, he got tricked in. But even more basic, who is the Ifat Toar? Isha Ahuva or Isha Snua?
The one he loves.
The one he loves. Right, the parallel seems neat until you think about it. She is the beloved wife. The Ifat Toar, the beautiful woman, is the beloved wife. The hate, right? And where does the rebellious children come from? Right? Right, the other one, right? Not the Ifat Toar, from the other one, from the Snuah. So, yes, as the Midrash says, the hated children come from the Snuah, but that's wrong. The Ifat, you're supposed to end up hating the beautiful one, not the other one, right? There's that one infelicity in this parallel. So, Rav Tamir Granot, and I forget his first name, Wolf, co-wrote an article. They have a clever suggestion. I'll suggest it for now, and we'll come back to whether I think this is right later. There's a moment in Rachel and Leah's life that could explain the switch, which is another switch. Right? There was another switch, and that's what you just said, right? Which is, right, who did he want to marry? Rachel. Who did he end up marrying? Leah. So when he thought he was marrying Eshet Yifat Toar, he thought he was marrying her when he married Leah. So if you want to follow the parallel, there's a neat way of fixing the problem, which is, yes, Rachel was the beloved wife and the Yifat Toar, but because they swapped getting married, Leah became the first wife who was married because she was Yifat Toar under the mistake, and all the problems that come from Yifat Toar followed from that swap, because he ended up hating his first wife, who he thought was the Yifat Tawar, and loving his second wife, and the firstborns came from the hated wife, right? So the switch switched everything. He thought she was the Eshet Yifat Tawar, and therefore he hated her, and her children were rebellious, right? Which is a neat move. It's a very neat way of explaining the lack of parallelism. Okay, but what's the message, right? And is this even true? So here, I think there's two radically different ways that the Midrash takes this, or Mefarshim take it, including the Midrash. One way of taking all of this is to say, the message of this story is that the laws of Eshet Yifat Tawar, Isha Huvasnua Ben Saramora, of the captive wife, of the hated wife, and of the rebellious child, is a legal critique of what Yaakov did in his life. Right, if you turn to the next page, a chart, right? It just follows, right? He marries a Yifat Tawar. He ends up hating her. He ends up having rebellious children. And it all happened because he did what he shouldn't have done, which was preference the child of the beloved wife over the children of the hated wife. And that's 8, right? We know, V'Yisrael, Ahavet Yosef, Mikol Banav, Kiven, Zikunim, Lov, Asa, Lo, Ktoret, Pasim. He loved Yosef more. He gave him a colorful coat. Out of it, we get a Broadway musical, right? And that is, right, that's history. Why? V'Yiru Echav, Kiyoto Ahav, Aliyem, Mikol Echav. And listen to the words. V'Yiru Echav, they saw. Ki Ahav, because they loved, right? He loved Yosef Mikol Echav, Vayisnu'u Oto, and they hated him. Now those words are all from these parashiyot, right? You see, love, which leads to hate, right? That's all from the original unit, right? He saw, right? You see the beautiful woman, right? Which causes hatred. Right here is they see the child of the beautiful woman, and it leads to hatred. V'lo yachlo l'daro l'shalom. They can't speak friendly to him, and the rest is history. So I think one way of taking this would be to take this as a biblical critique of Yaakov's choice in life. Now, whether that critique is of showing favoritism to Yosef, or that critique is of marrying Rachel in the end after he had already made the mistake and married Leah, leading to a situation where he was married to two wives, is debatable. But one way of taking this is a legal critique of the narrative of the Jacob, Rachel, Leah, Joseph story continuum. Basically, the second half of Genesis. Or it could be the exact opposite. It could be that this is not a critique at all. The parallel is correct, but it is in fact an endorsement of what Yaakov did. Now, how could it be that? So if you look at 9, this is, the Sforno writes this. He says, Lo ya'avira b'chora min ha-ben b'shvil sinat zo avat zo. He notes one little thing that we've sort of elided. The Torah says, why can't you preference the child of the beloved wife over the one of the hated wife? Because? The other way. Why are you preferencing the child of the hated, of the beloved wife over the hated wife? Because you love her, right? That's why you wanted to preference it. Why did Jacob preference the children of Rachel over... I'll take that back. Not why did he preference Joseph, because that was because he loved Rachel. But why did he reject Reuven, the children of Leah, from their status as Bechor? Was it because he didn't like them? No. It was because of the rebellion. Right? It was because of the rebellion. Right, as we saw before, he rejected Reuven because pachas kamayim al totar, because he slept with his, right, or whatever it means, but according to the simple read of the psukim, he slept with his father's wife, and Shimon and Levi because they wiped out a city. So maybe his favoritism led to their rebellion, but the reason he took away their rights of the firstborn was not because he loved Joseph more, it was because what they did in light of that situation. So the Sfarno says the opposite. This looks like a parallel, but it isn't. If you give away the status of firstborn because you love the other child, that's a problem. But if you take it away because the children are not worthy, it's fine. Azra'ui la'avir, if you'll just look at the English, then it's proper to transfer the first rights from the firstborn. And then he cites a passage from Bava Basra 133, that if the firstborn did not conduct himself properly, his inheritance may be transferred to another better one. It appears that this is what Yaakov did when he took birthright privileges away from Reuven, transferring it to Joseph. And he has a good proof to this, which is if you look at, skip to 11 for a moment. The verse in Divrei Hayamim in Chronicles 1 says as follows, just look at the English. The sons of Reuven, the firstborn of Israel, parentheses, right? This is not my parentheses, this is the author of Chronicles, parentheses, right? He was the firstborn. But when he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, son of Israel. So he's not reckoned as firstborn in the genealogy. Though Judah became more powerful than his brothers, and a leader came from him, yet the birthright belonged to Joseph. So it's not just the Svarno speculating. Like the author of Chronicles says, Reuven lost his status as Bechor, not because Jacob was preferencing Joseph, but because he didn't deserve to have the firstborn right. And then it notes that who ends up being the leader? Judah. And Judah is the first proper child of Leah, the hated wife, because Reuven sleeps with his father's wife, and Shimon and Levi wipe out of town. Judah is in fact the firstborn, right? The fourthborn, but the first worthy child from the hated wife. And he in fact, according to Jacob's blessings, this is not even a later development, according to Jacob's blessings, gets the gift of leadership, of kingship. So if not a birthright, correct. So there's a little bit of an ambiguity, right? Some of it goes to Joseph, and Joseph gets a double portion, but Judah gets the leadership rights. But what Divrei Hayamim, what Chronicles is outlining is, it's not really true that he took it totally away from Leah. He took it away from the illegitimate children, and then he gave part of the birthright to Joseph, and the leadership component he gave to Judah, which is in fact the first worthy child of Leah. So the Svarno takes this and says, the parallels are very nice. Except, the lesson isn't what you think it is, right? The lesson is, yes, he had hated wives, and despite the fact that he hated wives, he didn't take away the firstborn right from Leah because she was hated, and he left the leadership in the hands of the first proper child of Leah. He gave the Bechora to Yosef because he was the firstborn of the other wife. And once you took it away from Reuven, so you give it to Yosef. But that's not his fault, right? Reuven, Shimon, and Levi all weren't worthy. So one way is to say, yeah, there's a parallel, but it's not a critique at all. Now, I think I would suggest that this is part of the dispute in number 10. Because you have a dispute in this passage that he's citing from Bava Basra. Look at the English. The Mishnah says as follows. If a person gives his estate in writing to strangers and leaves out his children, his arrangements are legally valid, but the spirit of the sages finds no delight in him. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, if his children did not conduct themselves in a proper manner, he will be remembered for good. So the first opinion the Mishnah says, never take away the firstborn rights from the oldest child, no matter what. And the second one says, take it away if they're not worthy. And the Talmud comments, the question was raised whether the rabbis were in disagreement with the views of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel or not. What then is my answer to the inquiry? Come in here. Samuel said to Rabbi Yehuda, sharp one, keep away from transfers of inheritance, even if they be from a bad son to a good son. Yes, there is in fact a dispute about this point. Why is there a dispute in the Talmud about whether one should take away the firstborn rights from the firstborn if he's not worthy? I think they're disputing, how do you read the commentary of the three units that we started with? The beloved, right, the captive woman, the beloved and hated wife, and the rebellious child in light of the Jacob stories. One way of reading that narrative is, as we started with, Yaakov's life unraveled because one decision, right? Well, a series of decisions, right? To marry both women and give preference to Joseph over the other brothers, and that led to their rebellion, and that's why we had to reject them, and it was that consistent following of this path that led to the unraveling of Yaakov's life until the end of the life where things started to come back together. That's one narrative. And I think that's the position of Rishon ben Gamliel, because he looks at it and he says, well, wait a second. Yaakov married Ephah Tohar, ended up hating his wives, had children that were rebellious. But what made his life unravel? The fact that when he had rebellious children, he didn't try to bring them in. He rejected them and took the Bechor and gave it to the other child. That's what led to everything in Bereishis and everything in Genesis. It must be that when the Torah said, never take away the firstborn rights, it meant never do it. Like, look what happened when you did that to Joseph. Like, that is a disaster. That's one perspective. The other perspective is, no. Don't judge him so harshly. Because despite the fact that it's true, he didn't, right? He loved Rachel more, and he showed favoritism. That was a problem. He still, as it says in Chronicles, he didn't take away, with all of that, he did not take away the firstborn rights from Yosef until Reuven wasn't worthy. And then he took it away from Reuven. And that's the model for us, right? Now, those are not actually totally two distinct ones, because you could come up with a middle position, which is you are allowed to take away the birthright from an unworthy child. But it could still be a critique of Jacob and say, yeah, but why did you have an unworthy child? Because you had a beloved and hated wife, and because you showed favoritism. You may have been right in the end of the day to take away the Bechorah, but you weren't right for creating a situation that led you into this morass of family politics that is infamous, right? Rabbi Broid likes saying, sort of cynically, that Genesis is the book of dysfunctional families, right? But there's something to that. Like, the second half of Bereishis is a disaster, right? It's like there's some reconciliation at the end, but like it is a mess, and so they could go together, right? That yes, there is a critique of Jacob. The question then is, how far does the critique go? Does it go all the way to the end? Meaning, he also, despite all of this, should have left the first rights to Reuven? Or no, by that point he was right. He shouldn't have gone to this point. But once he was there, Reuven didn't deserve to be the firstborn. But I think both positions in the Talmud, even though they don't say it, are looking at the link of these two stories and are trying to figure out, okay, well, what's the message? Right? Yeah.
Why do Chazal assume that just because Jacob showed favoritism to Joseph, that would have caused Shimon and Levi to murder all of
them? Well, there's good reason in Pshat to say that. I'll try to just answer it in 30 seconds, which is, Yaakov doesn't seem to be very upset, shall we say. Or in Shimon Levi's mind, Yaakov is not upset or upset enough when his daughter is raped. If you listen to the language in their speech with him, right, their critique of him is very, very specific, which is, we have to defend the rights of our sister who was raped, because hachizona yaser achotenu, right, should you make our sister, right, a prostitute? And if you follow the language, right, it's a very specific choice, our sister, because our sister implies, right, our whole sister, our full sister, meaning the reason you don't care is because she's the daughter of Leah, because she's our sister, right? If this was Yosef's sister, you would have done something, right? So there's reason to believe that part of their anger isn't just directed at, you know, Shrem and Hamor, but it is directed at Yaakov for, right, not, right, part of the reason they feel like they need to act by themselves is because, right or wrong, it may not be that Yaakov, right, actually felt that way, but they've lived their whole life feeling second rate, so then, here, our daughter, right, our sister from Leah is captured, and you are going to be weak, and you're going to be impotent, right? It must be you're doing that because she's our sister, right? So that would be unshot, what I would answer there. Okay, now, the Midrash, right, I didn't make this up whole cloth, the Midrash picked up on all of this, and if you look in 12, right, we can do, at this point we can just read it in the English, right? So you look at the top of top of the third page, that she will not find favor in his eyes. What is written afterwards? If a man has two wives in the house, strife in the house. Furthermore, if one is beloved and one is hated, or both are hated, what is written afterwards? If a man has a wayward or defiant son, anyone who married a Ephah Tohar will have. What? Oh, I put the wrong one. Oh, I think I put the translation the wrong one. Sorry. Oh, or did I? No, I turned the wrong way. That's what I did. I knew. Okay. Turn to the back, the last page. I just turned to the wrong page. When a man has two wives, that is Jacob, as it says. And Yaakov was a simple man. Two wives, Leah and Rachel. One loved, that is Rachel, as it says. And he loves Rachel. One hated, that is Leah, as it says. And God saw that Leah was hated. And it will be on that day that he gives inheritance to his sons. When he was about to pass from the world, Yaakov called his children. He may not treat as firstborn the son of the loved one, to Yosef. Why? For he shall recognize the son of the hated one, that is Reuven, as it says, Reuven, you are my firstborn. Even though he says his disgrace, namely, unstable as water, you shall not excel. What is Yitzu'ei Allah? Right? What do those words mean? When Moshe comes, where it says, and Moshe went up to God, he will redeem him. Meaning one day Moses will redeem Reuven from infamy. When Moshe prayed for him, as it says, Reuven shall live. When he blessed the tribes, he said, Reuven shall live. Yechi Reuven val yamot. And God responded, and shall not die. Meaning, he was acquitted by both. As it says, you shall recognize the firstborn, the son of the hated one, to give him double. Reuven shall live and not die. Reuven shall live in this world and not die in the next. Why? For he is the first of his strength. As it said, my strength and the first of my seed. And the Midrash goes farther here. And it says, not just was it legitimate for him to reject Reuven. He didn't reject Reuven. Because they go back to those same verses in Chronicles and they say, yes, he didn't give him double, but what did he call him? Both in Breishit and in Divrei Hayamim, Bichori Ata. You are my firstborn, right? And in the end of the day, the fact that with all his anger and taking away the rights of the firstborn, he didn't deny that Reuven was his firstborn, led the way for Reuven to be reintegrated into the family. And the way that Midrashically read it is that Moshe reintegrates him later. And you look at just one more in 13, Tedelecha, right? Know that this is the case, for even when he sinned, he was referred to as the firstborn, as it says, the children of Leah, the firstborn of Yaakov is Reuven. So I think the first two perspectives we could raise here is that the rabbis see a strong literary parallel for good reason between the progression of the captive woman, the two wives, the rebellious child in the life of Yaakov. One way of reading this is a all-out critique on Yaakov. You married a woman because she was beautiful. You married a second woman and hated her. You had those children and you showed favoritism to the child of your beloved wife. And they rebelled, and that's why. And that's why we can never do that again. The second way is a little bit more, right, nuanced, which is, yes, he married a beautiful woman. Yes, he loved her more, but he only rejected them in the end of the day because they didn't deserve it. Yeah, he showed favoritism, and you shouldn't show favoritism. That was part of the problem. But despite that, he clung to the notion that they were his children, and that Reuven was his bechor, even if he wouldn't get the rights of it. And because, despite everything, he still held on to recognizing they were part of the family, even when it was hard. That's why in the end of the day, he may not have given them the rights of the Bechor, but Reuven, Shimon, and Levi all remain as tribes, and all remain in the family in the historical sense. So the second way is to mix criticism of Yaakov with a recognition that he made some mistakes, but he was fighting against some of those tendencies. And yes, he showed favoritism, and he shouldn't have done that. But despite that, he was trying to keep everyone in the family, and he was trying to keep them as the Bechor. And it was only after things spun out of control that he really rejected them. And even when he did really rejected them, it wasn't a full rejection. It was a temporary rejection. Eventually, on the national scale, they'll be brought back in, and Moshe will give them a full blessing, and it'll all be okay in the end of the day, at the end of days. I could end the shir here. And it's basically neat. Right? Okay, there's a progression. He marries Ifat Tohar, he has hated wives, he has rebellious children. Is it a full critique? Is it not a full critique? Whatever, that's the story, we're done. The last part, I call it, is it's complicated. Because this would be nice if this was Yaakov's life. But this is not Yaakov's life at all. And the truth is, if you follow Yaakov's life, these parallels come up not once, as I just presented it, but over and over again at every part of his life. So you look, for example, 14. Vayazov kol asher lo. Joseph, right? We're in the middle of this swamp of this story, right? Joseph has been sold into slavery by his brothers. He's there in Egypt. And he's been sold, right, and he's in the house of Potiphar. And Potiphar trusts him. Vayazov kol ha'shelo b'yad Yosef v'lo yada ito mi'uma ki'im alechem asher ochel. And he trusts Yosef implicitly. Vayehi Yosef yifei toar v'yifei mar'eh. Joseph, the son of the Eshet Yifat Toar, suddenly gets described as Ish Yifat Toar, the beautiful man. And what is about to happen in this story? He is, think about it, he's the daughter of the Ish Yifat Toar. He's an Ish Yifat Toar and he is a
captive.
And what is about to happen to this captive? Exactly what's supposed to happen, which is Vahi achar advarim ma'ele v'tisa eshet adonav ereinel Yosef Vayomer shachva imi. And the captor's wife turns to him, right? Just a flip, because he's a man, and says, lie with me. Right? So here you have the son of the Isha Yifat Tawar, who himself is a Yifat Tawar, and a captive. And the captor turns to him and tries to sleep with him. And what happens?
He rejects her.
Right? And here we have a breakdown of the story. Right? Because here we have somebody who overcomes. He is the Yifat Tawar. He's the son of the Yifat Toar. The captive comes to him and wants to take him, and he rejects her. And what does this do to the story? At this point in the story, what starts happening? This is the beginning of, right, we're here, right? His life goes like this, right? Sold into slavery, then he goes down to prison. That's like the lowest point. But that's the beginning of, right, this is how he becomes king, right? As soon as he makes that moral victory, right, this starts the trajectory out of this mess. So, that's once. But it comes up many, many other times. So, for example, we started that Lavan comes and says to Yaakov, how can you treat my daughters as Shvuyot Charev? Okay, good. When did that story happen? At the end. Right? He married Yifat Toar, right? He marries Rachel, he marries Leah, he hates Leah, has children, Lavan chases him, and now you have, don't make my children, right, captives. But wait, that's the wrong part of the story, right? This is much later in the story, right? This is after Ahuvas Nua, meaning, yes, it describes them as Shvuyot Charev, but it's later in the story, that means it's coming up again. And where else? We've talked about this case a few times, but we should think about it more carefully, which is Dina, right? He has a daughter, this time from the hated wife, who, what happens to her? She gets raped, but I didn't put the psukim here. She goes out, right? Vateitse Dina, right? Ki teitse la milchama. She goes out, and what happens? Vayar, right? She's seen by Shechem ben Hamor, and he is overcome with desire, vayyaneha, and he rapes her, right? So his daughter is literally in Eshet Yifat Toar, right? Pshuto kimashma, like literally. She goes out, she's captured, right? And she gets raped, and it leads to war, right? More, right? Yaakov's life is full, right? The rebellious son, right? The rebellious son. So, beginning of Yaakov's life, beginning of this whole story, right? How does Yaakov's whole fight with Esav start? Yitzchak wanted him to, wanted to give the bracha to Esav. And what does Yaakov do at the advice of his mother? Deceives his father. So, who's the rebellious child? Well, I don't know. I can't say it's Yaakov, because it's not really Yaakov, because he's listening to his mother, right? And it's not like a planned thing. It's not like a history of rebelling against his father, but he definitely has a bit in his life of this tension between his father and his mother, and right, going, right, tricking his father, right? There's these themes, but more importantly, Esav, How is he described when we first meet him, right? The Binsorah Mordor, the rebellious son, as we know him in Torah, is Zolel Visovei, is a gluttonous and gluttonous drunkard. The first time we meet Esav is, right, as an adult, is he takes the, he buys the Bechora, right? He sells the Bechora, rather. Vayochal, Vayesh, Vayakam, Vayelach, Vayivez, Esav, Bechora. He eats, he drinks, he runs, and gives up the Bechora. So what do you have? You have a glutton in the context of switching the firstborn rights from the older child to, right, to the younger one, right, to the wrong child. So if you look for themes from these three units of switching the firstborn rights, of people who are gluttons, of people who aren't listening to parents, of Yifas Toar, you get this mix, this mess of those themes coming up over and over again, sometimes in the right order and sometimes in the wrong order, right, by Yosef, right? It's the captive who, right, overcomes his desire, right? He rejects the, right, he rejects the captor and manages to get out of it, and that leads to eventually, right, the redemption, but it starts with more slavery. Right, I just gave you right here a chain, right? It, so you have, right, Dina being the Ahuva Snua, but then you have the war, right? Instead of the war followed by the captured woman, you have the captured woman which leads to war, right? You have these, right, themes which come up, but in random orders sometimes in Yaakov's life, which is why I call this, it's complicated. And Chazal, just to make it more complicated, suggest that Esav was the, who we said was the Zolel Visovei, who therefore should be the rebellious child. Chazal put him as the paradigm of Kibbut Avayim, of respecting his parents, right, in 15 and 16. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel said, all my days I served my father, I did not serve him 1/100 of what Esav did for his father. And Yitzchak said to God, let us judge him favorably. This is the Midrash. Didn't Esav honor his parents? God said he will eventually destroy the temple, right, because of his rights as being the respecter of parents. So you have Esav, who's Zolel Visovei, but also known to respect his father. And you have Yaakov, who's the good son, but a little bit rebellious, but not totally rebellious. And you have, you know, you have the Yifas Toar, which leads to war, and then you have the Yosef being Yifas Toar again, and you have this over and over, and you have these themes and these language appearing time and time again in his, in his life. So you could just leave it and say, yes, it's complicated, we're going to move on, and you know it's complicated, right? That's the answer. Is it looks neat, but it's not. But I'd run this shiur by a friend of mine, who then forwarded it to a friend of hers, a guy who I still have not met, but I've had some conversations with him, and it was very helpful, Elinatan Kupferberg. And he suggested nicely, and I think this is a good way to end with it, that maybe it is sort of random, but it's not. Because the theme that runs through Yaakov's life is the question of, do you let yourself get carried away, right, by desire, right, instead of doing what's right, right? And he said, the lesson in the end of the day of the three units of Yifat Toar and Ahuva Snua and Binsorah Mordor is, if you get overcome by desire, right, that marriage isn't going to last, right? And if you do that, your sons are going to rebel. But he said, look at the Yaakov story. He did marry a beautiful woman. And maybe at some level that caused some problems, but wait a second. Did Yaakov marry her for the wrong reasons? Like, right, was there any reason not to marry her? No, right? He met her, right, fell in love with her. She happened to be beautiful, but he ends up spending time, right, working for and developing a relationship with her, right? Yaakov, yes, there are some problems, but he's actually someone who manages to overcome, right? He's not, it's not blindly overcome by desire the way the person in the Yifat Toar story is. And you know what? It's true that he marries her, she's beautiful, and ends up having a hated wife, and that leads to some of his kids rebelling. But the fact that he didn't just fall for Rachel because she was beautiful, that meant that his son from that is the daughter of the Yifat Toar, but not, right, the one who will have the strength to turn down, right, the benefits of having been the beautiful son. Right? So yes, at some level, there's a right and a wrong, right? It's Yaakov is, yes, involved with the Isha Yifat Toar, but he's able to overcome mere desire, and that's why the son from that relationship, when he turns the tide, he does it because he has that moral force in him, right, to turn the tide. It's not just the Yifat Toar. And yes, Dinah is the Ephah Tohor, but she's right captured. And whatever you say about Shimon and Levi, yes, they felt like they were the hated children. That led to it. But there's also a moral voice there because they recognize that merely capturing a woman is a problem. So yes, the themes come up over and over. And yes, there's somewhat of a critique of Yaakov. But part of the lesson is that, yes, he shouldn't have favored the kids. But that notion of not just being animalistic and being overcome by desire is something that he did try to adhere to. And in the end, Yosef adheres to, and that's why he turns down Eshet Ephah Tohor. And that's why Shimon and Levi, yes, they may have rebelled against him, but they rebelled in the name of morality, in the opposition of people becoming Eshet Ephah Tohor. And the end of the day, the Torah is teaching you, on the one hand, yes, not to favor the kids, but the other hand, to recognize the danger of sheer desire and recognize that that was a strength in Yaakov's family, of being able to overcome that. So it's complicated, because Yaakov was a complicated person. He did fall in love with someone, and that led to problems because he showed favoritism, but on the other hand, he had that clear moral voice and moral strength of character that, at the end of the day, was one of the things that led his family back and made it that they weren't purely rebellious and they would be entered into the family, because Yaakov's moral lessons did trickle down to his children, which led to having, as the Chazal say, a mitash lema, where all the Shvatim were eventually integrated back into his family. I think we now move to the next year.